From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Cadet. You're listening to Idaho Matters. When it comes to American history, especially around 1850, two women stand out as lightning rods for dramatic change in society. Harriet Beecher Stowe's best-selling anti-slavery novel had a profound effect on how white people saw African Americans that some say helped lead to the Civil War. Harriet Tubman rescued dozens of Black people from slavery through the Underground Railroad and never stopped fighting for the rights of African Americans and women. The Two Harriets is the title of an upcoming talk at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute in Boise by history professor Dr. Richard Bell from the University of Maryland. And we asked him to come back on Idaho Matters to talk about these two phenomenal women. Dr. Bell, it's really nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin our conversation with Harriet Beecher Stowe. What do we know about her?
We know quite a lot. As a white woman of a certain, you know, elite economic status, she was well known in her own life, in great part because she was the daughter of the most famous preacher in America of that age, Lyman Beecher, the famous preacher. She also married a man called Calvin Stowe, a professor at a religious college, becoming Harriet Beecher Stowe. And she's known to us today primarily just for one part of her career as a writer, which was authoring in the early 1850s an anti-slavery novel called Uncle Tom's Cabin, which used the techniques of fiction to animate and energize white readers, theoretically, both in the North and the South, against the specter of Southern enslavement. And what's important about this anti-slavery novel is that people read it. People read it in very large numbers. We consider it today to be a blockbuster in terms of book sales, alongside something like, I don't know, a Harry Potter book or Prince Harry's new memoir or 50 Shades of Grey. This was a breakout hit for this young author. And many scholars have begun to investigate what effect it might have had on moving the needle in American society to get more white people to care about the plight of enslaved Black people suffering in the slave state. So it's a book that had a great impact, many scholars think.
So do we know where exactly she got the idea for Uncle Tom's Cabin, or was it, really from lived experience?
It was from both those things, of course. We know a fair amount about the origins of Uncle Tom's Cabin because she wrote on that subject in some follow-up pieces. She was a writer living in Cincinnati for a while and then moving to Maine when her husband changed jobs. And when she was living in Cincinnati, Ohio, she was, of course, living very close to what we call the freedom line, the boundary between free soil states like Ohio and nearby slave states like Kentucky, which is just, you know, a mile or two south of Cincinnati across the Ohio River. So Cincinnati was a major hub on the Underground Railroad. There were freedom seekers coming into Cincinnati while Harriet Beecher Stowe lived there, and there was a vibrant free Black community. Her own cook was a free Black woman. I think her name was Eliza Buck. And Eliza Buck told her employer, Harriet Beecher Stowe, tales of what it was like to have been enslaved earlier in Eliza's life in, I think, Louisiana. And that brought home to Harriet Beecher Stowe, I think, the lived experience of slavery for Black Americans, which for, you know, a nice white lady was very difficult to imagine without someone telling you to your face. So that connection with Eliza Buck and other members of Cincinnati's fugitive free Black community was important inspiration for writing Uncle Tom's Cabin. It's also true that Harriet Beecher Stowe was a voracious reader of the newspapers, which in that era, the early 1850s, were filled with descriptions of Southern enslavement, you know, from runaway slave ads where enslavers post notices to try to achieve the recapture and re-enslavement of those who've sought freedom, to editorials by clergymen or even survivors of slavery like Frederick Douglass. So the newspapers were another major source of information to her. She was also starting to read what we might call memoirs or autobiographies of survivors of slavery. Again, Frederick Douglass is a great example. He published his first autobiography, he wrote three, in 1845. And then Josiah Henson, who may be less familiar to many of us today, but who wrote an account of his enslavement in Maryland and being trafficked across the country into the Deep South. And we know that particular memoir by Josiah Henson was one that Harriet Beecher Stowe modeled the character of Uncle Tom upon. Mm. So she's drawing upon the lived experience of Black Americans who she's either read about or knows personally.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Bell, is it true that Uncle Tom's Cabin really started out as a magazine serial?
Yes, that's absolutely right. So Harriet Beecher Stowe will write Uncle Tom's Cabin in, I think, 1851 or 1852. It's published a year later as a full-scale novel, but it was first issued in a women's literary magazine, a chapter at a time over multiple serializations. This was pretty common, actually, as a way to tell long stories. Charles Dickens wrote a lot of his novels as serial contributions to magazines over the period of a year or two. So Harriet Beecher Stowe is following, I guess, in that well-trodden path. And she had written for women's literary magazines, women's religious magazines and periodicals for some years prior. That's how she cut her teeth as a writer. Most of her early work, whether it was fiction or nonfiction, usually fiction, was much more apolitical. Uncle Tom's Cabin is really the first time she embraces anti-slavery as a political agenda. And she proves she has, I think, a particular knack for delivering a political message, an anti-slavery message, in dramatic, narrative-driven forms with characters you care about and want to find out what happened to them.
So from there, then, how does the book go? I mean, how does this magazine serial then become a book?
So she was getting very positive reader response from the issuing of chapters of this story as standalone pieces in the magazines. And it was obvious to her publishers and to her that there was not only more money to be made by issuing it as a standalone book, but that its political impact could be greatly amplified if people could buy it and read it between covers all at once. And again, this was a common model. Charles Dickens would serialize first and then publish the book as a standalone a year later. So this is the model here. But what's extraordinary, mm-hmm. of course, is the sales. Regardless of how many people had read it in serialized form, and that's a pretty small number of people, the readership for the book itself was, you know, measured in the tens of thousands. There were loads and loads of reprints. So the original publisher pushes out a second edition and a third edition, a fourth edition, et cetera, et cetera. All of which sell out. The book is translated into various European languages for the overseas market almost instantaneously. It's a big hit in Britain as well, where many white readers there are sympathetic to the anti-slavery fight in America. They produce mm-hmm. illustrated editions, so younger readers can also engage with Uncle Tom's Cabin. They produce abridged versions. They produce stage adaptations. If it was being published today, it would have been made into a movie within a year. That's how impactful its publication as a standalone book was in the early 1850s.
So impactful that President Abraham Lincoln truly believed that this book caused the Civil War.
That's right. One of the famous quotations attributed to Abraham Lincoln, among thousands of famous quotations attributed to Lincoln, is a rather poetic little one that, according to one story, when he met Harriet Beecher Stowe in the middle of the Civil War, I believe the year was 1862, he turned to her and said, "Oh, you're the little lady that started this great war. Now, I should say, it's not definite that he actually said that. So just take the spirit of that quotation in mind. But that idea, you're the little lady that started this great war, is built upon a common awareness at the time that the commercial success of Uncle Tom's Cabin had been so great that perhaps it had had a dramatic effect on the readers who'd purchased it, that those readers who were already anti-slavery sympathetic, got more engaged in the cause, radicalized, if you will, and those who were apathetic to the anti-slavery cause previously were motivated to learn more about the anti-slavery movement and how they could join and how they could participate, and maybe began reading other anti-slavery tracts and books, which weren't as well written as Uncle Tom's Cabin. And there was even a sense that many Southerners had read the book and hated it so much that they had often doubled down on pro-slavery ideologies. So historians take all these slivers of evidence of reader response and say, Uncle Tom's Cabin's publication seemed to drive people into their corners, amplifying the extent of anti-slavery sentiment in northern free soil states and amplifying pro-slavery sentiment in many southern slave states. So a hardening of what historians would call the sectional divide, the regional divide between the North and the South, which of course will explode into civil war. So Harriet Beecher Stowe definitely did not fire the first shots at Fort Sumter in South Carolina in 1861 or anything like that. But there was a sense that her literary work had driven things to a precipice which could only be resolved by collective violence.
You know, listening to you, Dr. Bell, it's interesting how there are these moments within our history where, you know, as you said, right, divided people, put them in their corners. But by doing so, it inevitably forces change to happen, right? Yeah, I mean, what Uncle Tom's Cabin did to maybe, you know, help the Civil War maybe start sooner, right? You can look at the Equal Rights Movement, the Civil Rights Movement in the 60s, right? Even what's happening in our country today. Do you see certain, I guess, similarities in that almost like awakening of society at certain points in time?
I think it's a fair question. I think, to go back to first principles, that ideas matter and more narrowly, words matter. And every great civil rights campaign is often instigated or accelerated by people of literary talent who are able to distill complex political ideas into forms that leave an impact on the people that encounter them. So Harriet Beecher Stowe's great contribution is to make plenty of honestly apathetic white Northerners give a damn about the experience of Black suffering in the South. And that's an incredibly important moral divide that she was able to bridge. And for a comparison, the one that jumps to mind is not to do with the anti-slavery fight. It would be Thomas Paine's Common Sense, which is a political pamphlet published in Philadelphia in January of 1776, which makes the argument to the American colonists that all their decade of grievances against King George and Parliament, all the mistreatment they have been laboring under, should be resolved not by more petitions asking for better treatment, but by separate nationhood and political independence. His great genius as a wordsmith, he's a very talented writer too, was to crystallize grievance and put it in the form of a self-help book, saying you don't have to take this anymore. Independence is within your grasp. There are some differences between Paine and Harriet Beecher Stowe, of course, but fundamentally, words matter in the battle for hearts and minds.
Let's now talk about the other Harriet. This is Harriet Tubman. What do we know about her early life?
There are some things we know, and there are some things we don't know about Harriet Tubman. Enslaved people do not often get to write or preserve their own records of their early lives. And so what we know about them either comes from their subsequent writing, if they're able to free themselves and gain their literacy, like Frederick Douglass, for instance, or because they appear in plantation management records written by their tormentors, their enslavers. And for Harriet Tubman, who never wrote a memoir as an adult, most of what we know about her young life, her life in slavery, comes from plantation records. We know that she was born with a different name, Araminta Ross. Her loved ones called her Minty when she was growing up. She was born in, I think, Dorchester County around 1822. That's Dorchester County, Maryland, I should say. And so she grows up enslaved on Maryland's eastern shore. She is put to work from a very early age. This would have been a wheat and cereal crop slave labor camp or plantation. That she is very mistreated as a young person. As an adult, she will bear the physical scars, in addition to the psychological scars, of a lots of mistreatment at the hands of her enslavers. And by 1849, when she was, I guess, 27 years old or thereabouts, she refused to take it anymore. And she took to her heels and ran, escaping that slave labor camp largely on her own. She invited her husband to join her, but because all his family members remained behind, he declined, and set out for free soil, which at the time was in Philadelphia, about 40 or 50 miles to the north of where she was enslaved in Maryland.
So what do we know about how and why and when did she get started smuggling people out of slavery?
Yes, I wish we knew everything we wanted to know, but we often have to look at the behavior and then sort of figure out what it means about her intentionality and goals. She's quite an enigmatic figure in that regard. But we know what she did. After getting herself free, she began working in a boarding house in Philadelphia and saving money. And from that, we might think that her plan is to move further north, away from Maryland, away from slavery, maybe end up in New York or Massachusetts, as Frederick Douglass did when he escaped slavery. But that's not what she's planning for. Beginning in 1849, she will spend the next, I think, 10 years making 11 journeys back into the slave states for the purposes of encouraging her friends and family members and other loved ones to come out of slavery with her, to guide them to their own liberty. We call this, of course, the Underground Railroad, the network of people who would help freedom seekers free themselves. Harriet Tubman, of course, as an African-American woman and as a fugitive from slavery herself, was putting herself at extraordinary danger to go back into the slave states, where she was literally a wanted woman with a bounty on her head of about $12,000, and to do this over and over and over again. There are very few other people like her, whether white or black, who expose themselves to this particular sort of danger. And as a result of her efforts, she helps about 70 people directly liberate themselves. And she gives advice and instruction to at least 50 more. Harriet Tubman, quite simply, Gemma, is an American hero, and it's long past time we acknowledge that fact by putting her face on at least one of our banknotes.
Absolutely. So I would believe, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that it is a fair assessment to say that she truly is the face of the Underground Railroad.
I think that's a great assessment. Face in a couple of different ways. Harriet Tubman was a doer. Her actions, I think, speak volumes. Unfortunately, when we think of her, she's often silent and muted in our heads. So we should remember that as well as being a doer, she's also a talker and a speaker. She gave mesmerizing speeches across the Free Soil North on all sorts of lecture circuits designed to raise money for exactly these sorts of missions. So she's more than only a doer and a face and a speaker. She's all those things. But she's also become, I think, in our historical imagination, the one person we think of when we think of the Underground Railroad. And if you had to only think of one person, Harriet Tubman's a great choice. But I also think that we should remember that she is at the vanguard of a small army of free Black and free white people doing some version of this work. Not everyone is going into the slave states and helping men and women free themselves, as she does. There are many other people staying on the Free Soil side of the line who open their houses and basements as safe houses, who provide donations and clothes and food to freedom seekers. Frederick Douglass never went on a rescue mission, but when he lived in Rochester, New York, he and his wife, Anna, provided shelter and sanctuary to a total of perhaps 400 freedom seekers on their way to Canada. So it's important we acknowledge all the other people involved in the Underground Railroad, even though it's entirely appropriate to place the emphasis we do on Harriet Tubman, who was this action hero, for lack of a better word, who lives up to all the expectations we've placed on her shoulders. She's really an astonishing woman.
So can we talk about Harriet Tubman after the Civil War? Because in a lot of ways, her fight for freedom and equality didn't stop with getting enslaved people out of slavery. She took a part in the women's suffrage movement.
That's absolutely right. And that's part of her career that we often don't give enough time to. We often struggle to think about people as multidimensional actors committed to different campaigns. And yet many of the great anti-slavery figures of the 1850s, I keep coming back to Frederick Douglass in my comparison, Gemma, were also involved in other campaigns beyond the anti-slavery fight. And like Douglass, Harriet Tubman is involved in the fight for Black women's voting rights after the Civil War. There is a strong organizing effort among Black women to try to advance their cause for political representation, though sadly that cause is often thwarted by, first of all, divisions within the women's rights movement, where plenty of white women's rights campaigners do not think that Black women have a place in that campaign, and also by the success, ironically, that Black men have had in getting the vote after the Civil War. There's a sense among white politicians that haven't we done enough? Look, Black men can vote, what more do you want? Which, of course, is very short-sighted. So Tubman is someone who continues to push for Black female suffrage, continues to push for the rights and care of Black veterans in the Civil War and for Black children, opening the equivalent of an orphanage in upstate New York after the Civil War, and lives a long life and dies many, many decades later. But one thing I want to quickly mention here, Gemma, is her work in the Civil War itself. Much of her Underground Railroad work preceded the Civil War in the 1850s. Much of her suffrage work will be after the Civil War in the 1870s and onward. In the Civil War itself, Harriet Tubman is anything but a bystander. She serves as a scout and guide for Union troops early in the war. And by the end of the war, we know that she becomes the only woman who I'm aware of, whether Black or white, to lead Union troops into combat in the Civil War. The occasion is a raid by Union troops, many of them African-American, on a series of slave labor camps run by Confederates in South Carolina outside Charleston along the Combahee River. And Harriet Tubman is helping to devise that raiding plan with Union commanders. And then she is the one tasked with executing that plan, giving instructions and directions to Union gunboat captains as they raid one slave labor camp after another, with the astonishing result that at the end of one day in the Civil War, Harriet Tubman, as the leader of troops, has been responsible for helping around 700 enslaved people behind Confederate lines free themselves.
Well, as you said, Dr. Bell, she truly is an American hero, and to finally, I think, at least have some acknowledgement of all of the works that she did is about time. So I really appreciate the conversation today about both of the Harriets.
Happy to be here.
We've been talking with history professor Dr. Richard Bell from the University of Maryland about his talk on the two Harriets. It's coming up at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute on Tuesday at the Yonke Center in Boise. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, we're taking center stage. Introducing NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of Black-led stories from NPR's podcasts. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.